The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon.
Well, good afternoon.
Yeah, we've already spilled coffee on Bill's computer, and
It's not smoking or anything, so it must be okay.
Yeah, we've had all our pratfalls already. We got them all out of the way right there in that first couple minutes.
It's addicted to caffeine, like I am.
Oh my gosh,
it's my computer.
Bob, how's it going?
You were supposed to wait till we went on air to do that.
Yeah, sounds of a struggle. Oh my gosh. Anyway, we have a really fun show today. We have Mr. Patrick Wood on with us today. We're going to talk about technocracy again. And, you know, I say again because it's kind of, it was a groundwork for all sorts of things. And I got his email update. Hey, you know, Patrick, you're going to have to send me a link on how people get your email updates. What's the method that they use?
They can just sign up on the list at technocracy.news. That would be an easy way to do it.
Okay. I'll add a link on there for that because the emails are great, and they cover all sorts of different things. And as I was looking down the list, I thought, time for another show. Got to get them on. It's like, okay, it's getting away from us now. The technocracy has mushroomed. So all the things that you need from us, you can find online at wethepeopleradio.us. I know it's confusing. The .com was taken but not used, irritatingly enough. So wethepeopleradio.us will get you to all of our archives, always the current show. It has a nice link there on the top if you want to join the chat room during a program. And then by 2:30 or so, we have a copy of the program in archive form posted on the website. And then later in the afternoon, Robert makes us a commercial-free copy, usually splits it hour, you know, 1 hour and the second hour. So if you miss any or all of it, you can forward that to somebody. Appreciate it if you post on, I guess you could post on Facebook, but I don't like Facebook as much as Twitter. People really follow Twitter. And since we started using it, I don't know, views on the website are up over 30,000 something since December. So
yeah, a lot of folks on Twitter.
Very good. All right. That's all the business end, right?
Yeah.
We're good?
Yeah, I think you did good.
All right. Try to have some organized beginning.
Yeah. Keep your coffee to yourself, and I think we'll get along just fine.
We've only been doing this for, like, what, 5 years? And now we have an organized beginning. It's probably ruin all the fun, but what the heck. So, Mr. Wood, what would you like to tell people about yourself? Because I don't really have a bio posted for you. What I have posted is why you wrote the book Technocracy Rising. But maybe you could give folks a little bit of background on yourself.
Yeah, that was good. Well, you know, I've been writing about globalization for almost 40 years now.
Jeez.
Wow. That's hard to believe. I don't know what to do with that. It's not exactly depressing.
You must be old. Oh, wait, so are we.
I know, it is.
That's why we care.
Gosh. You know, and half the things I talk about, I was an eyewitness to. That's scary too.
That is, but you know, in a good way, this isn't something that you learned on the internet, since obviously there was no internet.
There was no internet.
Did we have microwaves then? I don't think we did. I know I didn't. That was a long time ago. So we were all still. My nephew asked me one time when I told him we didn't have microwaves when my kids were little. He said, did you have to cook your food on a fire?
There you go.
I was like, no, honey, we actually had stoves and stuff. We just didn't have microwaves. No fire. So back when you were cooking with fire, what were you doing that brought you into all this?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have established a relationship with a man by the name of Anthony C. Sutton after he had left the Hoover Institution for War, Peace, and Revolution at Stanford University. And prior to that, he'd been a professor of economics at UCLA for several years in Southern California. And then he went to work for the Hoover Institution as a research fellow, did tremendous work there. He was very highly respected for his early works, especially. And he got forced out of Stanford University. And I happened to run into this this guy down in New Orleans at a gold conference of all places. He was had been invited to speak there. And as I remember, I think I was going to do a workshop or something. And somehow we just got seated at the same table for breakfast at the cafe in the hotel. And it was European seating at that point. The hotel was so busy that you sit where we put you if you want to eat. Well, okay. I didn't like that. I hate to sit down with strangers. You know, like, oh, my gosh, what am I going to say? And anyway, we struck up a conversation. And after about 30 minutes, we knew we had a huge story in this organization called the Trilateral Commission. And Tony had been studying it. He realized that that's what got him forced out of Stanford, because David Packard, the president of Stanford, was one of the founding members of the Trilateral Commission.
Oh, surprise.
And yeah, surprise. And so they didn't want Tony to be on the hunt, so to speak. Tony had a reputation at Hoover. They called him affectionately the Hoover vacuum cleaner. He was that kind of researcher. And once he got his bloodhound nose on a trail or something, he didn't give up. He never gave up. And he went to the ends of the earth to dig up stories, literally. So these people, plus he was very knowledgeable, and these people at the Trilateral Commission did not want to get him, and especially tied into a prestigious organization like Hoover, to start writing in a negative way about the Trilateral Commission. So they go, doink, drop kick, boom.
Yeah. Wasn't Al Gore part of that commission, or was that later?
Oh, Al Gore came along later.
He was busy inventing the internet then.
That's true. He was really tied up.
He was busy architecting the internet.
Thanks for that.
But Gore and Clinton both came in the late 80s, so they were kind of latecomers to that crowd. But we started writing about the Trilateral Commission immediately. I had the means to do so because I was running a printing operation in Scottsdale, Arizona, and printing newsletters for other people. So that, you know, I had the means to immediately kick into gear to do something tangible. And so we started a newsletter called the Trilateral Observer, and we printed it we did a monthly publication for about, probably about 18 months. We co-authored it. Tony contributed some, I contributed some. I did the publishing, and we used direct mail to build a subscription. And after about 18 months, we realized time for a book. And so we took the monthly newsletters we had, put them together, and edited the whole thing to tie it together. And we produced the first volume of Trilaterals Over Washington. And about a year later, we produced the second volume of Trilaterals Over Washington. And it did become the definitive analysis on the Trilateral Commission in the early days, and it stands today as still being really the work to go to if you want to know anything about the Trilateral Commission.
And how was that received in the Washington on the Hill? Was that were you guys kind of pariahs after that?
But back then, it kicked up quite a storm. We sold about 75,000 copies within a couple of years. It was pretty amazing.
Wow,
and that. That was enough to have put us on the New York Times bestseller list. They required, I think, 25,000 in the first 6 months or year or something. But, of course, they didn't put our book. They didn't put our book up.
Yeah, they just missed it.
Yeah, really. Lots of crickets there.
I know. And we debated several members of the Trilateral Commission on the radio, kind of a point-counterpoint sort of thing. We did a lot of radio work back then because talk radio was just kind of starting, but it was very fruitful for us to get the message out. And a lot of the radio hosts liked the idea of doing point-counterpoint debates. So we'd find out where the members of the Trilateral Commission lived, like what city they lived in from the United States. And we'd call up radio stations in their town and say, hey, you got so-and-so living down the street there. Why don't you contact them and get them on the air and let's do a little debate? And a lot of them fell for it. They thought, oh, yeah, what a great idea, you know. And so they'd get some member of the Trilateral Commission on, and we'd go at it. And they universally lost. I mean, we just slaughtered them.
Because
as soon as they opened their mouth, people just went nuts. I mean, what? You're doing what?
What were the tenets? What would be the things that they would say that would initially alarm people? Because it didn't take much.
Well, it didn't. And they were talking about creating this new international economic order. And even though we know a lot more about that today, like what's happened with some of the treaties like NAFTA, for instance, that stripped out American industry like crazy from our country and sent it overseas. but in the early days, remember Jimmy Carter was the one that was in office at that time.
Oh, yes.
And Jimmy Carter was universally unliked.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we would challenge him on things, and I don't know if if this was even an issue with you back then, but Jimmy Carter was the president that gave away the Panama Canal.
Oh, yeah.
That was sovereign U.S. property, just as much as Alaska. We owned that, lock, stock, and barrel. It was it was sovereign U.S. territory. And Jimmy Carter gave it away to Panama because Panama was going bankrupt and couldn't pay its debts to U.S. banks. And so a scheme was hatched to send a commission down there to study the whole thing. I mean, we used to bring this up, stuff like this, when we were on the radio. We'd bring this stuff up. And Caspar Weinberger headed a commission that was appointed to facilitate the transfer of Panama Canal over, and Congress was never involved in this, not once, which is patently unconstitutional. It was outrageous as some of the stuff that Obama's doing today. It was just patently treasonous. So this Weinberger Commission was set up to negotiate away the sovereignty of it, send it back to Panama. And the banks got bailed out in the process, out of the big banks like Chemical Bank that were owed buku bucks. They got bailed out of it. The commission had 8 people on it, and 7 of them were members of the Trilateral Commission. 7.
Wow.
And it's like, huh? What?
Yeah.
This smells.
It seems like they've got a hold of everything.
Oh, my gosh, they did. So Carter did a lot of stuff like that that was easy to pick on. We just, you know, you just kind of throw the bone out and say, well, sir, how do you respond to this? How is it that 7 out of 8 people in this commission could be appointed by a supposedly unconnected president, you know, and all of the only people in the world that get appointed to anything important are members of the Trilateral Commission? And they'd have a hard time answering that. For the most part, they would answer something like this. They would say, well, we really look for good people to belong to the Trilateral Commission. It is an exceptional, extraordinary group of men and women.
Of course it is.
And that's why they always get picked. Just happen to be, you know, they're the champions or whatever, they get picked.
Hey, Pat, hold that thought. We better take a quick break or we'll have them all at the end. Bob's giving me the high sign. We will be right back. You are listening to We the People Radio. Please join us online at wethepeopleradio.us for all the information about our guest, his book, and bunches of other good stuff. Be right back.
In the year 2525, if man is still alive, if woman can survive, they may
Yikes. It's in the pill you took today. God, that's not that far from the truth. You'll have to play us the rest of it and find out what happens in the future. Who was that anyway?
You don't want to know what happens in the future. You do want to know it was Zager and Evans.
Oh, wow. I knew the song. I didn't know that, though.
One Hit Wonders.
There you go. That's why I didn't know who it was. Okay, so now we know what's going to happen in the future, and we ruined the whole show. Let's go back. We have Patrick Wood on with us. He is the author of Technocracy Rising. Sure, easy for me to say. And it's a great read. Seriously, a great read. Hey, give folks a little definition of technocracy, just because we keep throwing the word around, and just because we've done shows about it doesn't mean they actually know what we're talking about.
No, yeah, that's helpful.
I kind of forgot about that.
There's two ways to look at technocracy. One is, if just look it up in the dictionary, you'll see that the dictionary just says basically is government by experts, you know, like people who know what they're doing.
Bob just fell off his chair.
You know, I'm glad we have people running the sewer department that know what they're doing, what valves to turn, and, you know, what to do in case there's a leak. We appreciate experts, but technocracy with a capital T is something altogether different. That was a movement back in the 1930s that was literally, they prescribed a replacement economic system based on energy distribution and consumption and run by engineers, scientists, and technicians. And the best definition that I can give you to kind of like the real deal is from the Technocrat magazine that was published in 1938. This is a direct quote. I got to copy this magazine when I went to do some research and archives up in Canada, and I caught this, so that's cool. I'm going to hang on to that. Here's what they said, okay? Technocracy is the science of social engineering, the scientific operation of the entire social mechanism to produce and distribute goods and services to the entire population, close quote. Now, that's what they said it is. So it's the science of social engineering, for one, and it's the scientific operation of all of society, the purpose of which is to produce and distribute goods and services to everyone. And at first glance, you think, I don't know, that doesn't shock me, doesn't ring my bell, doesn't knock me over. But here's the essence of technocracy. These people, these scientists and engineers back in the 30s, and it hasn't changed now, by the way, same type of people are saying the same thing today. They want to take over the means of production and consumption. They want to take it over entirely.
So we'll get what they decide.
We'll get the products that we'll get are the ones they decide to make. The products that we're allowed to consume will be the ones they allow us to consume, and in which quantities. And so choice is out the door. Supply and demand principles are out the door. Free enterprise principles are out the door. All that kind of stuff is out the door. In fact, it's such a sea change facing us right now. I just have to throw out this quote from the United Nations. In particular, the lady's name is Christiana Figueres. She's the czar of climate change at the United Nations. Her title is Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. How'd you like to have that business card?
Yeah.
Wow.
Here's my card. You pull out three cards strung together. You've got to fit the whole title on there.
Yeah.
Executive Secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. She was in a press conference earlier this year, and this is exactly, precisely what she did. I listened to it, transcribed it. This is it. Quote, "This is the first time in the history of mankind that we're setting ourselves the task of intentionally, within a defined period of time, to change the economic development model that has been reigning for at least 150 years since the Industrial Revolution." That's what she said. It's incredible.
Jeez
Louise. If anybody needs to read between the lines here, she's talking about capitalism and free enterprise, folks. And she went on to say, this is probably the most difficult task we've ever given ourselves, which is to intentionally transform the economic development model for the first time in human history. Close quote. And, you know, people have told me, well, you know, okay, so they're adding a green flavor, you know, they're going to do solar panels or something. You know, it's like, whatever.
Right.
You know, just transform doesn't mean transform. It just means we're doing things just a different. We're going to, we're going to kind of keep an eye on environment as we do business from now on. But when the United Nations uses the word transform or transformation, look it up in the dictionary. This is our language, right? We speak English, right? That's it. Only English. We have a dictionary that tells us the meanings of word. And if you or anybody else doesn't know the meaning of a word, that's not my problem. And it doesn't mean it doesn't have meaning.
I think it wouldn't have scared people so much, but since we got Obama, I think the word transformation's taken on a whole new fear level.
I know, but here's what the dictionary says: a thorough or dramatic change in form or appearance. Now, synonyms used in the same thing: mutation, conversion, metamorphosis, transfiguration, sea change, reconstruction, morphing. Okay, that's transformation. This is not just some little wimp makeover. They're talking about replacing the whole stinking economic system of the world with sustainable development. They also call that at the UN their green economy. This is so huge, I just can't express it. It takes my breath away when I think about it. It gets back to the redistribution
of wealth. I mean, that's now is the UN, are they the forerunners and the ones that are really pushing the technocracy, or is it organizations that are springing out of the UN? I mean, who's at the forefront?
Not at all. The people who started this thing from scratch were members of the Trilateral Commission. That's the only reason, honestly. This was my takeaway from the 25 years I did previously studying the Trilateral Commission. I never understood what they meant by new international economic order until I discovered technocracy, the historical movement of technocracy.
So is
and
the
what I discovered
is the tri-
my, there
is
was a kind of
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you.
Is the Trilateral Commission, are they feeding this information to the UN then?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
It's so overwhelmingly obvious that when you see it, when you see the evidence of how they were involved in it, you go, uh-oh, I get it. I mean, just instantly.
Right, and it's not a tangential relationship. I mean, these guys have burrowed in and started from the very they're the framework.
They have provided 100% of the framework to get where we are today, and they're hiding behind the dresses of people like Christiana Figueres. They push her out front to do the dirty talk, and they're hiding behind her, just smiling quietly, drinking their scotch, smoking their stogies. I don't know what they're doing, honestly. They probably don't do that.
You never know.
You never know. They're hiding behind the curtain, pulling the strings on this. And they've been doing this now for 40 years, and these turkeys need to be exposed. That's my whole mission right now in this whole business with technocracy. Let's call a spade a spade. I'm reminded, there's a good example of calling a spade a spade. The incident up in Roseburg,
mm-hmm.
where a bunch of people were killed by a young guy, everybody in the press calls him the shooter. The shooter. I think there was a movie called The Shooter one time, or maybe The Shootist or something. They call the shooter. And he killed, I don't know how many people, I don't remember how many people, he killed a bunch of people. And it's a very conservative area up there, by the way. So when Obama decided to go there, they had a huge protest. Get out of here, you bum. We don't want you here. Go home. I don't think Obama probably even heard him, but that's another issue.
Right.
But here's a guy. He's called a shooter. Now, I'll tell you what. This guy is not a shooter. He is a murderer.
Yeah, true story.
They're dodging the truth of the matter when they call him a shooter, because if he's a shooter, then guns are the blame for it.
Yep.
But the guy's a murderer. In the Ten Commandments, it doesn't say, thou shalt not be a shooter. Excuse me.
Yeah, the top ten didn't actually mention that word. You're right.
I know. It's like, you shall not be a murderer. And this guy's a murderer. Well, listen, here's my point. All of this nonsensical talk about sustainable development, climate change and all, the whole mantra that goes through, all this Agenda 21 stuff. take it all in the big bundle, all of it. Take whether smart grid or geoengineering or Common Core education standards or property rights issues, everything you can think of that's wrapped up in Agenda 21. You take that whole big stinking mess, and you can wrap it up, and you can trace it back to these members, early members and later members of the Trilateral Commission. They have been the one that have implemented this stuff. They stand buck naked before the truth, and the truth isn't very hard to discover. I found out the truth is right there in plain sight. It's not even hiding. It's just in plain sight, but nobody wants to look at it. So they call it everything else under the sun except what it is. And what I call it is the biggest scam in the history of the world. It's a scam they're pulling on us. And it's just as transparent as I've ever seen anything in my life. Of course, I've been studying and looking at this stuff for 40 years. Other people might not come to my clarity of vision for a while until they really look at it. But this is the biggest scam in the history of the world that these people are pulling off. And they've changed the whole nature of the game using technocracy as intellectual fodder, I guess. Yep. And it's interesting that the early technocracy movement had no institutional support from the Rockefellers or the Carnegie Mellons or any of those people. The Ford Foundation, they didn't give them a second look. But when Zbigniew Brzezinski wrote his book Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era in 1970, everything changed. Rockefeller all of a sudden saw the light, got together with Brzezinski and says, hey, we're going to roll with this baby. And they said, starting on day one when the Trilateral Commission was founded, that they're going to create a new international economic order. And as it turns out now, there's only one model in history for an alternative economic system. Only one in history has ever been designed, and that was technocracy from the 1930s. Period. End of subject. That's it.
And I want to go through what made them blow up back then and why did we not hear about them. Let's take a really quick break, and when we come back, we'll do that, because it's kind of interesting how these guys are hiding right in plain sight, and that's kind of what did the other guys in, except other people knew what they were looking for. Anyway, we'll be right back with Patrick Wood. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
I took a walk around the world to ease my troubled mind. I left my body lying somewhere in the sands of time. But I watched the world flow to the dark side of the moon. I feel there's nothing I can do.
Highly unlikely that'll happen, but I like the hell no part. You're listening to We the People Radio. We're here with Patrick Wood this morning talking about the, I don't know what it is. It's the enslavement, honestly, of the world population, because that's really what happens at the end. They wind up being the boss of us in every facet of our lives. Ain't that so, Mr. Wood?
It is. This is kind of pushing it
back. I'm like,
back,
hey, do you concur?
Like a neo-feudalism that we had during the Dark Ages.
Yeah, we can only, according to their, if you look through the plan, you know, because there will be tons of people who will say, oh, if it's the UN, you know, they're not dangerous. They move like a snail, which they do. But why is this so? Why are they going to? Why are they able to do this so quickly? I guess
they're gathering momentum as time goes on. The way a project works, let's say you're going to build a skyscraper or a big apartment house. You see those go up around occasionally. Let's say you're a developer and you're going to build a big apartment complex, and you figure that if you start today, It's going to be actually built and ready to accept renters, let's say 2018. That's 3 years from now. And so you got to do a lot of stuff. You got to raise financing. You got to get a concept. You got to go out and find some land. You got to build, you got to hire an architect once you get there and go do a whole bunch of stuff, getting permits and stuff along the way. You got to get engineers in to look at your design. And there's tons of stuff you got to do. And you do all those things before you even take a shovel out to dig the first, scoop of dirt. And so if you had 3 years to launch a project like that, nobody in the world, in other words, drivers by, nobody in the world is going to know what's going up on that piece of property until they see the foundation go in. Then they go, oh, look at that. Somebody's doing something over there. And then they come back a week later, and the whole frame is up. You go, holy mackerel, how'd that happen? I was just by here. I didn't see, man, they're working fast.
True.
And then the next thing you see, they got a sign out front, open, you could be living, if you lived here, you'd be home or whatever, And they're filling the thing up. And you go, man, I've never seen anything go up so fast in my life. Well, that's not true at all. There was tons of groundwork and stuff that had to go into it before you ever saw the first part of the superstructure. That's the nature of a project. I don't care what it is. That's the way project management is. 90% of the effort goes into planning. Mm-hmm. 10% goes into execution. And this is what we see here. People just need to understand this is the way life works in big projects. Doesn't matter if you're building a nuclear submarine or a skyscraper or a new international world order. This is the way it works. These people have been planning and jockeying for decades to get where they are today. The fact that we see the fruit all of a sudden is kind of immaterial to the big picture of it. Well, of course we're seeing the fruit. They're starting to build the superstructure now.
Well, the technology in the time frame, as time goes on, the technology, I don't know what the stats are. I forget. You read them every now and then. At how quickly the technology is doubling. And so, yes. And so the capacity to do these things is absolutely being aided by just the expanse of technology and the availability of it.
It is. And they factored that into their plan, by the way.
I'm sure they did.
As things move forward, they know that technology is, advancing incredibly. They make use of it every way they can. But this last meeting, for instance, that took place at the United Nations on September 25, that's the one that the Pope came and spoke at.
Mm-hmm.
That meeting drew all the nations of the world in. This was their plenary session where everybody comes in, all the prime ministers and the leaders. Obama was there. And the United Nations put before them this 2030 agenda document. And they said, this is a wonderful document. We know that we're going to eradicate poverty now. We're going to really do it this time. And all you got to do is, for all these great benefits, you need to sign on and commit to this document, even though it was extremely vague in what it said. You need to just sign on to this document, commit to making these radical changes in your country, in your economy. And we'll get to the details of it later. But these 180 fools that came to the United Nations and listened to the Pope, sing the praises of climate change and sustainable development, they all lined up to sign the stupid document. Globally, they drank the Kool-Aid, took the red pill or whatever color pill it is, all at the same time.
It's probably red.
Oh, man, we're for that. We want to eradicate poverty. Why? We want to have education opportunities for all. And, we want to do all these good things. We want to get rid of disease and blah, blah, blah. And so they signed up for it. Now, okay, how long did it take the United Nations to get all the nations of the world together and primed massaged to sign this document? It didn't just happen at the last spur of the moment. There was a lot of groundwork went in before it. Same thing was true with the original Agenda 21 document back in 1992. That didn't just fall out of the sky. They didn't negotiate this at just that Rio meeting. In fact, it was all a done deal by the time they got to Rio. Nobody really understood it at the time. But the entire Agenda 21 book had already been written. It was already ready to go to press. The United Nations just took them and manipulated them, kind of like a Delphi meeting, right? They just took them and manipulated them and said, man, this is great. You've all had input. You've all put your stamp of approval on it. Now sign it, you turkeys. And they did. They just blindly signed it. And Agenda 21 is born. But a little bit later, the United Nations came out and said, well, where this really came from was from the Brundtland Commission that terminated in 1987. It had run for 5 years, 82 to 87. And the Brundtland Commission, led by a lady by the name of Gro Harlem Brundtland, she was Prime Minister of Norway previously, she was the chairwoman of this commission that created a book called Our Common Future. Now, I know you've seen this book, probably seen a copy of it at least, if you don't have it. Our Common Future, the United Nations says, was the singular book that paved the way for Agenda 21. And every single thought and, you know, idea that ever worked its way into the book of Agenda 21 is found in the book Our Common Future. And that book still colors virtually everything of sustainable development today. In fact, Our Common Future really coined the phrase in the popular context, sustainable development. They're the ones that came up with the phrase. Now, Gro Harlem Brundtland just happens to be a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Oh,
there we go.
Isn't that just a fun little coincidence?
Big surprise.
You see? Well, it is a surprise. It's like, you mean all the sustainable development stuff, all this smart growth, smart grid, smart this, smart that, all this stuff, green economy, is all a put up by the Trilateral Commission? That's exactly what I'm saying. It is.
How do these people become a member of the Trilateral Commission?
You get tapped like a fraternity or a sorority.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if you remember how that works in college or if you were in a situation like that in college, but when you go in as a freshman, typically, they have a week where they have parties. It's called Rush Week.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to go around to the parties, these different, you know, different frat houses and stuff, and sorority houses if you're a woman. Guys don't go to the
Actually, I don't think it matters anymore. Everybody's using the gender bender bathroom.
Depends what pants you have.
We're going to have gender bender sororities now.
Yeah.
And frats.
Back then, that was the case. But you go to a party and you kind of chat up with people and you hope upon hope. If you end up at a party where, oh man, I'd love to join that for, that's the frat I want. I want to be that. I want to be with those people. You hope upon hope that they're going to like you enough to where they come tap you on the shoulder and say, come with me. But you don't apply. Otherwise, just the fact that you're there at the party, you don't apply. So I want to, you know, where's my application? I fill it out. No. They watch you. They evaluate you based on your social skills and how you look and, you know, how you behave and stuff like that. They will come and give you a tap on the shoulder and say, we want to talk to you about joining our fraternity.
And what you have to offer.
That's right. But they pretty much already know, having observed you, what you have to offer, and that's why they're picking you. Well, that's the way the Trilateral Commission works. They have an executive search committee, that determines the people they want to tap for membership. There's no application process there. By contrast, by the way, there is an application process at the Council on Foreign Relations. They have an application. You can't even think about joining unless you fill out the whole application. They could deny your application, of course, and I'm sure they do in many cases. But there is an application process. You initiate that, and you're the only one. People initiate that process are the only ones that will be considered for membership. They don't spot somebody on the street or in business or whatever and say, hey, that guy's not a member of the CFR. You know, let's go down and hustle him. Well, maybe they do that. They might hustle some people, but you get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
You have to self-initiate.
How many of these people are in both? How much crossover is there?
Well, there's a huge crossover in the sense that the CFR has about 3,500 members in North America, whereas the Trilateral Commission only has probably about 150 North American members. So, number-wise, the Trilateral Commission is much, much smaller. You notice the control that the commission has over the CFR when you analyze their board of directors. The board of directors is elected from the ranks, supposedly, of the CFR. I think they have 40. I think it's 40. I want to say 35 or 40 directors. I don't remember right off.
And how many people are in the Trilateral Commission?
Well, there's only worldwide. There's only about 350.
Oh, okay.
So kind of easy to make these sweeping decisions with just that many people.
Yeah.
Hold on, we have to take one more quick break. I'm sorry about that, because we're pushing the top of the hour here, and
okay.
Poor Bob's over there pushing buttons like nobody's business. So we'll be right back, and we have you as our hostage for the second hour. So we're not actually running out of time yet. We'll be right back with Patrick Wood. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Smiling faces sometimes pretend to be your friend. Smiling faces show no traces of the evil that lurks within. Smiling faces sometimes they don't tell the truth. Smiling faces tell lies, and I got proof.
They tell me I am free in this democracy, this free society. They give me all I need on my TV. It tells me what to believe.
That's where I get all my information.
TV, yeah, absolutely.
If it's on TV, it has
cable.
To be true. Yeah.
Wow, that is spooky. Is there more, Bob? Oh, there's more. Hold on. How nice they have, like, the little quiet pan flute playing. Nothing scary here. No problem.
Sam Fear.
Sam Fear.
Switch channels, but they're all the same. Faceless lizards who are dealing the game. They take our freedom, but they never take the blame.
Wow, that was good too.
They say they open our eyes so we can see how they bite off all the world's disease, like AIDS, cancer, and terrorist plots, and WMD.
Okay, well, that was fairly comprehensive. I hope you all enjoyed that.
Hit all the hot spots.
It all rolls you up in Agenda 21, and it's being helped by your TV. I'm sure nobody believes that. Har, har, har. Hey, so I forgot the question we asked you last time, Mr. Wood, like a half hour ago. What happened to the trilaterals in the first round? Or not trilaterals, the technocracy guys in the first round. What blew their deal the first time?
Yeah, let's finish. The thought we had on the CFR that I was going to make is
okay,
that
so now it's not my fault.
40% of the directors of the CFR are members of the Trilateral Commission.
Oh.
And the head of the CFR is a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Of course.
So the question is, who controls who? You know, a lot of people say, oh, it's the CFR. CFR controls everything. No, they don't. I'm sorry, but the Trilateral Commission so overwhelms and dominates the CFR, it's not even funny. If anything, you can almost say that the Trilateral Commission owns the CFR in a lot of ways, and they use it to their own benefit, but it's not the other way around. So I'm sorry. I wanted to get that out.
No, good. There's kind of
a misconception about who's controlling who.
Well, you know, it's always the little group controls the big group because it's easier to get your, you know, stuff all in one sack if you're a small group.
That's right.
Hard to have an evil plot with way too many people.
Yes.
So how'd these guys blow out the first round?
I mean, back in the 1930s?
Yeah.
Well, they had two problems against them. One, FDR became president and gave us the New Deal. There was a lot of technocracy represented in the New Deal, by the way, but the early technocrats back in those days, one guy actually wrote a book and called on Roosevelt to declare himself dictator as soon as he got into the presidency. And just implement technocracy outright.
Wow.
They proposed to dismiss Congress summarily, and just turn the operation of the world over to the science and engineers. Can you imagine?
It just bundles it up, makes it a lot cleaner that way.
They really thought they had it all together there.
Well, they did, and they felt like they had some God-given mandate or something to take over the world. Mad scientist, right? Aldous Huxley looked at technocracy in 1932 and wrote Brave New World. That's where that book came from. That was his inspiration, technocracy.
And we all know how that turned out.
We know how that turned out. Scientific dictatorship. That's exactly where it's headed today. Huxley was not some clairvoyant. He didn't have a crystal ball. He's just a man, puts on his pants just like any other man. Well,
but he paid attention. He looked at who else was putting their pants on one leg at a time.
I know.
we're gonna roll us past the news here. On a quick note, I hope you stick with us here for the second hour, because there's a lot more to come. We need to look at how this fits into the Obama administration here of late, because 2030 is coming for all of us now. So it's not just about the past, it's about the future. Stick with us. We'll have Mr. Patrick Wood on second hour. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, yeah.
Good afternoon, and welcome back to We the People Radio for our second hour. That's going to go as fast as the first hour, unfortunately.
Yes, so it did. It flew by.
Listen quickly. You're joining Aaron.
And Bill.
And Bob.
We're here every Sunday from noon to 2 on the West Coast, and this show re-airs on the East Coast from 1 to 3 in Philadelphia and the Jersey Shore. At WNJC 1360 AM. They get all that right?
Yeah, very good.
On the Conservative Commandos Network, and 1 to 3 Mondays. So anyway, we'd love to hear your comments. If you have any ideas for shows or as topics or guests, people you've heard or read books about, think it'd be interesting, and stuff that doesn't get very much airtime, we are that great spot for them. So, join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Everything is on there. Tons of shows, 5 years' worth of archives, and we usually have a commercial-free archive posted by later in the afternoon on Sunday. So, if it's a time problem for you, you can get each hour down to about 40 minutes. And that is all. That is all the news that's fit to print. Okay, back to Mr. Wood. All right, Pat. On the technocracy thing, I remember reading in your book that what blew up the technocracy movement in the 30s, part of it, one piece of it, was that they had uniforms.
Yes, they had a paramilitary look.
I always thought that was like a bridge too far, huh?
Yeah, like a double-breasted suit, gray. They all dressed alike. They had a dark blue necktie. They had the men had broad brim hats, nice dress suit, type hats. And they all wore a little insignia. The corporate insignia was a monad symbol.
What is that?
And the women had a very similar outfit. Of course, it was a skirt and a dress, female oriented, I guess you'd say, but it was still double breasted. And it was a very striking look when you saw them all together. They even went so far as to contact Ford and General Motors and have them offer a technocracy gray paint for cars.
Wow.
Join the team. It's off a technocracy gray car. And not only would the car be gray, but the hubcaps were painted kind of an orange red color. It's very striking. This was technocracy.
Wow.
And they had this paramilitary look. That didn't fly too well. It looked a lot like the SS. And so when Nazi Germany really got rolling, especially when the U.S. got in the war, it's like, hey, man, this looks too much like who we're fighting over there. And, what's really kind of a telltale on that is in Canada actually outlawed technocracy for a period of 2 years.
Really?
Yes, they did.
And how would you do that?
They called them a subversive organization and shut them down.
Oh, you mean they outlawed it? Like you couldn't meet? You were considered a bad guy?
That's right.
Oh, not That's just right. the technology part of the technocracy, just the...
No, they felt there was too close of a look and tie and everything else to the Germans. And they said, you're not going to do this here. You're not going to... No more technocracy.
Wow.
They let them... They put them back into existence after a couple of years. And, you know, but that this you know, this wasn't lost on Americans either, I'll tell you. You know, they kind of got it. And they kind of got the idea also that technocracy was really a crackpot scheme. It promised utopia, but it couldn't deliver.
Sure.
It had no basis for delivering.
Just like now. And, you know, with their whole sustainable development, we're all going to live in a little rabbit hutch. And
organization-wise, how big did they get?
Well, there was over 500,000 card-carrying technocrats in North America at the height of the movement.
Holy cow.
And there was a lot more that were following the movement that weren't card-carrying technocrats. It was a membership organization when I say card-carrying.
Sure.
That's how they survived. You had to pay a fee, whatever it was, $5 or something, you know, to become a member. And that's how they were supported. They got no institutional money from anybody back then.
Well,
but they were out there. It was a very popular movement. California, Oregon, and Washington were really overrated with technocracy. Like there was a bunch of them there. And up into British Columbia, but really all the way across America and Europe, Canada, there was just tons of technocrats.
Wow. And and these folks then, how did when you did all the digging with Mr. Sutton on the Trilateral Commission, were any of those people the same people, or were they just an outgrowth of the same idea? Is there a direct connection there?
Well, there is, and you could call modern day technocracy neo-technocracy if you wanted to, just kind of to indicate there's a new flavor to it.
Okay.
Which there is. It's slightly different, but not much. But Zbigniew and Brzezinski wrote Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. Sutton and I had read that book and sliced it, diced it 6 ways Sunday. We knew it quite well. And that was really the book that got he and Rockefeller together. We knew that too. And we knew that the Trilateral Commission's New International Economic Order was a product of that thinking that Brzezinski brought to the table. We just didn't know about historic technocracy at the time. But it just so happens that original technocracy in 1932 was housed at Columbia University in New York City. They occupied the lower basement, or the basement of Hamilton Hall, well, half of the basement at Hamilton Hall, for a period of about a year before they got booted. And they did get booted. The president of Columbia realized that the promoter, the number one promoter of technocracy, was a fraud, didn't even have an engineering degree, and that doesn't fly well at a place like Columbia. So they kicked him out, and they went out, the two co-founders went out, started a corporation in New York City, and that's how Technocracy Comma Incorporated got started.
Okay.
But it started out at Columbia University, and even though they got booted, the scientists and engineers at Columbia never recanted technocracy. They just went into hiding. They knew they better shut their mouth and just take care of their own departments and teach. You know, just like, don't want to hear technocracy anymore. Okay, we won't talk about it. But we want to keep our jobs. You know, a lot of these people were tenured scientists and engineers. And so they just kind of, you know, went along with the program and shut up. But oddly enough, we find Zbigniew Brzezinski some 20-plus years later at Columbia University when he writes this book. He is a relatively young professor of political science at Columbia University when he wrote Between Two Ages, America's Role in the Technotronic Era. So there's a very direct connection through Columbia University, because those kinds of philosophies and movements don't die within academia. They continue to be discussed as part of the big melting pool of ideas. So there's no doubt that the science and technocrats and stuff at Columbia continue to discuss it in the cafeteria and, you know, at meetings, stuff like that.
Yeah, and I guess it's okay if they want to talk about alternative.
How great, you know, it would be if they ran
systems.
The world.
But it becomes the topic, and it becomes the the main topic of what they talk about anymore.
Yes. And I will say that technocracy, as I said before, did not have an institutional support back in its day in the 30s. And in that sense, Brzezinski and Rockefeller and that whole crowd of global elitists at the time, they really did hijack or plagiarize, if you will, the entire technocracy movement from the 1930s. And technocrats don't like to hear that today. I've talked to some people who actually still are members of Technocracy Comet Incorporated. And I say, well, does it upset you that your whole thing has been hijacked by these people and that they're using it for their own, you know, visions of global domination? And, oh, that's not true. Whatever. I mean, they just don't have a clue of what's going on around them. But, the movement as a whole was adopted by Rockefeller when he realized that he could use it for complete global domination. That was the deal. I just am absolutely certain that's what clicked in his mind when he and Brzezinski got together in those early days. He said, this is it. This is where this is going. We want to be a part of this. We're going to use it, manipulate it to control all the resources of the world, because that's what technocrats wanted to do. They wanted to take all the resources of every community, every state, and every district away from the people and manage those resources for the good of the people and let the people just have as much as they need.
That they decide that we need, actually.
That's right. How much they decide how much you need, and you will have that much. That was going to produce the maximum efficient society. Remember, as we talked about, technocracy being the science of social engineering. And so that would be the most efficient use of everything would be if we just control it and we just kind of tell people what's out there and how much of it they can buy. And otherwise, you don't have any need for private property. We'll take care of you. We'll make sure everything is out there. You'll have plenty of leisure time to go play and, you know, do whatever you want to do. Listen to music or read a good book or whatever.
Watch TV like the song Last Hour.
Yes.
Get all their information from the networks.
Yep. We'll show you what to think, and we'll explain that to you. So I guess we better thank our advertisers, since we still have some out here in the free world. We're going to come back with Patrick Wood. We're talking about technocracy and all the things surrounding it. If you've missed his previous shows, go to the website and look. You've probably got about 4 hours of potential listening at wethepeopleradio.us.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
Yes, and we know where that man will be living.
Yes.
Pat, we were looking on the website, on your website, actually, at your last newsletter, and we would be remiss not to bring up the Agenda 20, your article, Agenda 21 for Cities, 300 square foot condos for $275,000.
What a steal. Yeah.
I mean, honestly, this is like, you look at this thing and you go, oh, no.
No, don't put me in there.
No, how could this happen?
It's got everything you need, though, and no room for all that stuff you don't really need. And they've
it more likely resembles kind of a fancy jail cell.
It does.
You know, that's actually kind of true, because you for people that aren't looking at this, you should go to the website and look at it. But anyway, we the people. Radio.us, and you just look down on the newsletter that I've attached, and it's about the 300 square foot condos, and there's a lovely picture there. It's a little skinny place with a loft, but when you think of a loft, like there's room up there. No, no. This is basically just a thing that sticks out from the wall that is big enough to hold a bed. So you
crawl.
Yeah, you crawl up there like you're 8 years old and sleep in your little bunk bed. And when you come down the stairs, don't hurry because you'll fall in your sink. You have a sink and a sink and a counter. It looks like it's about like you couldn't lay on it. It's probably 4 feet long, and you have a desk with a chair and a really big TV,
a little stovetop and a little oven, and that's about all you really need.
Yeah, a little Davenport and an itty bitty little coffee table with little tiny metal legs. Do you go to the bathroom in the kitchen, or is there a bathroom we just can't see?
You know, I think there's a bathroom in there somewhere. I'm looking at the picture myself.
I was figuring the dishwasher doubled as a toilet or something.
I know. Yeah, the sink doubles.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and are people
look out for the disposal.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've been making this type of a living arrangement in Japan for a long time because property is such a high premium there that they've had little – Almost like that Seinfeld episode where he was stacking the little Japanese people in the drawers.
Yeah, that dresser.
The little dresser drawers, yeah. But this is a little bit of what's to come, it looks like.
Yeah, one of the most popular types of modular housing right now is made out of 40-foot shipping containers.
Hmm.
Of course, they're a little bigger, 40-foot by, 10 feet or something? That's 400 feet. That's actually quite a bit more than this one here.
That's moving up, yeah.
Yeah, when you're living in 300 square feet, 100 more feet is a really lot.
That's a big deal.
Big deal. Somebody asked me on this bed, how do you make that bed anyway? Well, I don't know. I don't think you can make
that bed
hardly,
a good question.
Except you crawl up on your hands and knees.
Yeah.
And somehow try and tuck the stuff in the side and make it look halfway decent.
Well, because you can't stand up and make that bed. I mean, you got to be on your hands and knees because you're almost up against the ceiling.
And where's all your storage anyway? You know, I mean, you got to have a closet. You got to have some other stuff.
Oh,
whatever.
Yeah. Where is that?
You'd end up living like in a pigsty, in my estimation.
Well, you'd probably just have,
stuff everywhere.
Two Greenpeace T-shirts and I don't know, all the rage now for the 20-something men seems to be these capri pants. It's so scary.
Yeah.
We saw some of those the other night. It's like, what?
But, you know, if you look at this if you live someplace that has no storage, which means you're not going to buy a bunch of stuff and have it sitting around your house like a lot of people do now, what's that going to do to our economy? I mean, for all these stores that sell all the knick-knack, paddywhack stuff, I mean, you're just they're going to go out of business because there's no place to store
it. Kill them.
Yeah.
You're right. But see, this plays into the whole Agenda 20, you know, the sustainable consumption mantra.
Right.
Because you're not going to be able to buy anything. You're right. Where are you going to put it?
Yeah.
You're not going to buy a big gas guzzling boat, or you live in a thing like this. You're probably not even going to have a car.
Well, in here, you can't even
bike rail.
If you bought a lamp, you couldn't fit it. Yeah, there's no. I mean, you couldn't put a blender, a microwave, a coffee pot, a lamp. You know, you look at just basic things that are in somebody's.
You just don't buy any of that stuff anymore.
There's not even room for plants.
This is what they want to do, a la Agenda 21 and 2030 Agenda. This is the whole business, 21 and 2030 Agenda. This is the whole business of sustainable consumption. They want you to cut back on everything you use. And that's the only way to reduce your carbon footprint. Now, I guarantee you, a single guy or woman living in an apartment like this, 300 plus feet, is going to have a low carbon footprint, according to them.
Mm-hmm.
This is the goal, to minimize the carbon footprint of every human on Earth. That's why one reason they want to herd everybody into cities and make them live in stuff like this. High density, high density, complete high density. This redefines high density, obviously. But, high density dwelling like this is what they're designing cities for today.
At the end of the day, you can't have a kid.
Not place.
Where are you going to put them? You need a coffee table that converts into a little stowaway bed there.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, it's pretty frightening.
I can't put my finger on it right this second, but I actually saw a statement one time reading some apologist for sustainable development in relation to these small little living quarters. And the guy said, well, why would you need any more space?
Yeah, why?
Yeah,
you know, what would you be wasting that for? Why would you need any more? Isn't anything more than this wasteful?
You know, it's interesting because, you know, when people look at it and think, well, how are they going to convince everyone of this? Well, I have a great current example. In California, if you look at 100% of the water, well, first of all, let's start with they want households to cut back 30% of their water use. So everyone's, you know, yards are dead. They're, you know, I don't know what they're doing with their showering. I've heard some creative alternatives. You know, you're not supposed to wash your dishes or flush your toilet and all that jazz. But so you look at that. They want to cut back household water use by 30%. And you constantly hear that agriculture uses 80% of the water. Well, the actual real numbers in California, 100% of the water, if you look at the real 100% of the water, 50% goes to fish. So you kiss off 50%, it's going down the river. 40% goes to agricultural and 10% goes to houses. But see, if you don't count the 50 that goes to fish and the rest of it is considered 100%, mm-hmm. if you lie about it, mm-hmm. if you basically cheat the statistics, you're looking at 80%. You know, you just double that ag number. But to get back to reality, 10% is households. So if we're cutting back 30%, 30% water cut back, they're saving, in reality, 3%.
Yeah, because they're cutting back 30% of the 10.
Of 10%, yeah. Which is the real number. So they're cutting back 3% of the state's total water use. How stupid is that?
And if you don't comply,
like the fish would notice 3%.
They'll send you a little added surprise on your water bill because somebody ratted
Bill out. Bill was using water at the wrong time. We got a letter that said exactly what time he was using it.
And this is my final warning. If I get caught using water during the day again on the wrong watering day.
Yeah, because you've affected that 3% savings statewide.
That's right.
Is that just crazy? But see, that's the thing. They've got everybody convinced that this really has meaning. I'm sorry. You could waste 3% of the state's water. No one will notice. And if that's the case, you know, if we can give 50% of our water away to fish, but just not tell anyone about it, you can get people to do all this, jump through all these hoops. So I don't know, talking them into living in 250 square feet or 300 square feet, maybe they guys get the guys who do California water policy to sell it.
Well, you know, they built a big rabbit hutch complex down in Walnut Creek that had all the living spaces upstairs. I think it was like four stories.
Yeah, and stores down below, the mixed-use housing.
Yeah, and they first had a hard time filling them because nobody really wanted to live, next to BART and downtown where there's no place to park a car.
Bay Area Rapid Transit for people who don't live out here.
And there were no – I think there was a Starbucks in all of the stores downstairs. Nobody moved into those business units. So, I mean, I'm just wondering how successful – are these complexes that they're building in some of these cities? I think in New York they're probably a little more successful just because of the density. But I think a lot of these towns, people have a choice of living there or living in a real house. They're not doing it. So for all they're saying about how successful this is, I'd like to see the real numbers.
Yeah, the only people going into these are young people. Who can't afford anything else so far.
Yeah, and I was reading, the reason for that is the rental market today is getting so expensive that young people can't save money to buy a house, and so they're forced into a rental situation or one of these little rabbit hutches, and that's about as good as it's going to get until something changes.
That's right. You know, if you went to college and you stayed in a dorm,
that's
true. Really no different than staying in a dorm room.
No, this would actually be kind of palatial.
Life?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I guess they expect them to do, because you could never socialize at your own house. There's nowhere to put them.
No, you have to go
to
a common area.
No, they have these common areas and stuff, supposedly, you know, where you can go and recreate and have a lounge and a TV and commingle, you know, with the other people in the community.
Yeah.
Hopefully like your neighbors.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you imagine?
If you got a bad neighbor, that kind of ruins the
one
whole
bad guy.
The whole common area, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, it's like communes. You know, communes failed because nobody wanted to live in them because eventually they all made each other mad and decided they wanted to wear clothes and, you know, eat meat or whatever. I don't know what broke up the deal, but my guess would be all that big love fest didn't really work out.
All that sharing.
All the sharing. Sharing sucks. Bob, do we have to take another break? Okay, we're actually on time today. We're going to take another quick break. Okay, when we come back, Pat, I wanted to look at your article about smart cities could signal the end of democracy. Because people think these smart cities are a great idea. Not. And we're going to explain why. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, give me land, lots of land under starry skies above.
Not a condo.
Don't fence me in. Let me ride through the wide open
nice,
country
Bob.
That I love. Don't fence me in. Let me be by myself in the evening breeze. Listen to the murmur of the cottonwood trees. Send me off forever, but I ask you please, don't fence me in, just turn me loose.
Get your ticket to that wheel in space while there's time. The fix is in. You'll be a witness to that game. You know we've got to win. Here at home we'll play in the city. I would buy the sun.
Perfect
weather for a streamlined world. There'll be spandex jackets, one for everyone.
Great ones.
What a glorious time to be.
Okay, everybody put your hands in the air and sway.
There you go. Spandex jackets for everyone.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the amount of spandex I've seen at the grocery store over the last 10 years could last me a lifetime.
I'm kind of over spandex.
I'm way over spandex. So, okay, in this Smart Cities article, Mr. Wood, my favorite paragraph, such utopian urban visions help us drive the smart city rhetoric that has for the past decades or so been promulgated most energetically by big technology, engineering, and consulting companies. So I think for the people who think maybe we're, like, you know, making this stuff up, see if this rings true. The movement is predicated on ubiquitous wireless broadband and the embedding of computerized sensors into the urban fabric so that bike racks, lampposts, CCTV, and traffic lights, as well as geeky home appliances such as internet fridges and remote-controlled heating systems, become part of the so-called Internet of Things, the global market for which is now estimated at $1.7 trillion. Better living through biochemistry gives us a way to dream of better living through data. Now, you know, anybody who doesn't see that we're sort of going this way is delusional, right?
Yeah, they are. And it's interesting, the people driving the whole smart city rhetoric, as they said, are the giant companies like Siemens, Honeywell, IBM, Accenture, which used to be Anderson Consulting, largest consulting company in the world. These companies have a lock on this, and what they're after is these what they think is going to be a $2 trillion a year market by the year 2020. This is big bucks, and this has always been about money, but this is huge money. And if these people can engineer, and these are the technocrats, by the way, if they can engineer a city like this to get and convince people to live in, good luck with that. But if they can, they're going to make so much money that it's just inconceivable of how much they're taking out in the process of this transformation. Just inconceivable.
Well, and interesting to me that the cloth shopping bag people and the hemp clothing and the, you know, the organic bunch is typically, you know, your liberal set who loves this kind of stuff. Yes, we should all be riding bikes all the time, and we should all live in these little rabbit hutches, and meat is destruction, and, you know, we shouldn't even go into the forest because it's we're people and we don't belong there. All these things. And the funny part is those same folks, to whatever degree they participate in that philosophy, universally hate big companies. Mm-hmm. And the funny part is their whole thing is predicated on these giant companies enslaving them. And that's what they're helping them do.
Yeah. I went on a safari when I was 18 years old. My parents were hunters, and they took me on a safari to Africa. And it was I learned a lot of things over there. I was young, impressionable. It was a lot of fun. Saw a lot of neat animals and stuff. But when you go on a hunt, you have people different have different functions. You might stand in on the side of a clearing. Maybe make a little blind for yourself with some branches, stuff like that. And you would stand there and you would wait for the other people called the beaters who would go out into the bush and they would circle around maybe a mile out and they'd come back through the area with noise making stuff like beating sticks together or maybe a pot and a pan banging them together. And those beaters would drive the animals out through the open spot in front of the hunters so the hunters could take their license. And everybody had their role. And in the case of the whole sustainable development crowd, the reason I tell you the story is the United Nations has become the beaters for companies like Siemens, Honeywell, IBM, etc. to beat the business to them, you know, to panic people into going for this stuff. And then the people waiting on the side of the clearing to clean house on it are these companies. Routinely the same companies. General Electric, throw them in there. And they're making out for trillions and trillions of dollars as people run headlong and nilly-willy into sustainable development and things like smart cities. They're just sitting there picking off the game as the game comes running through the clearance, you know, through the meadow, because the beaters are out there beating the bush and driving people that way. It's a scam. I'll say it again. I said it at the beginning. It's an absolute scam of magnitude we've never seen in history.
And they've just got these guys hook, line, and sinker, you know? The solar Prius, you know, whatever, we're going to save the world because we're the ones who are ruining it, folks.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're telling us, of course, that these new cities are completely efficient and, you know, much, much more forgiving on the economy or the ecology and stuff. And I've read a number of stories already that says that's just hogwash, that modern technology is not doing any favors whatsoever for the environment. And I know that there's a lot of argument on that still, but, you know, the evidence to me is just clear. It's no better than anything else man has ever done before, if not worse. It's just that, hey, when there's $2 trillion up for grabs, wouldn't you like to get a little piece of that? You don't need much. Well, how about even just, you know, just 5%? Would be five percent would be $1 billion.
Yeah, not bad. Yeah,
you're kind of reminding me of the whole high speed rail in California, man. There's vendors lining up for that just to get a little piece of it. I mean, I doubt if it'll ever be built, but there's going to be a lot of people lined up to get.
They're going to waste a lot of money not building it.
Might as well get a piece of it. It's nuts. Right. It's absolute nuts.
But we see companies like Siemens and Honeywell and IBM, we see them coming to drink at the trough every time you turn around with smart grid. Every time the United Nations goes burp, these are the companies that are there. They're always right there with their hand out. We can do that. We can do that. We can do that. Can't anybody see the scam for Pete's sake? It's like, who's driving who here? Is the United Nations driving these people or are these people driving the United Nations? And I can tell you the answer to that. They are driving the United Nations. It's the Siemens, the Honeywells, and the IBMs that are giving direction to the IBM sustainable development. It's their consultants, for Pete's sake, that are going in to these committees to testify and tell them how to do it. And so they go, oh, that's a good idea. Oh, smart cities. That's great, man. We like the sound of that.
Yeah, and that's about it, too. They do like the sound of it. So what do we do about it? I realize I left us less than 15 minutes to explore that side of it, so no pressure, yeah. But... Should we get them uniforms again so that people can see them?
Yeah, really, that would be nice.
Hey, let's get uniforms, huh? Yeah, and then they blow up again. That'd be great. Repeat history.
I know. We can't defeat an enemy we don't know. That's one. We need to see who the enemy is, truly. Americans do, because they don't see who the enemy is right now.
True.
But beyond that, I'll tell you, Americans need to get off their
rather
oversized rumps.
There you go.
Get off the couch. I want to be kind. I don't want to get you guys in trouble with the FCC or anything. They need to get up off their couch, get out of their house, and go down to their local, whatever it is, if they have a city council, a school board, a county board of supervisors, whatever they have, get down there and start mixing it up with these people. Find out who the enemy, find out who the nutcakes are within that crowd, and drive them out of your community. Because this has trickled down to every community in America. You can imagine what the rest of the world is like right now. But for any community who doesn't clean up their own house, they're going to get what they deserve. That's all I can say. I don't mean to be any way punitive about this. But for any community that refuses to go out and clean up its own house with this stuff, they will get exactly what they deserve, and it's coming at them like a freight train.
Yeah, it is, because once they roll out, you know, the smart meters and all that kind of stuff, there's really no going back, unless, of course, they all catch on fire on the same day.
Very difficult. So if you don't like things, if you don't like the cameras showing up in your town, you know, to take surveillance on every cotton picking thing, if you don't like the license plate readers that are being put in and installed all over America right now, if you don't like the smart grid stuff that's going on where they're starting to, you know, they want to control the energy in your house, if you don't like the way property rights are progressing, because of all of this new green zoning techniques and stuff, if you don't like the international business, the international standard for building codes that's being implemented all over America. If you don't like these things and you don't put up the resistance to stop it, you're going to get what you deserve. And I just hate to say it that way, but Americans need to be slapped in the face. What are you waiting for Pete's sake? These people are winning all over us. They're just beating us to death.
Yep. And it's interesting because you look at the little pieces that are contributing, and as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, it's interesting out here in California anyway, and I think it's happening in a lot of other places as well. You see the prison overcrowding being handled by letting people out of prison. Out here, the voters were dopey enough to pass a measure that turned a bunch of felonies into misdemeanors, so those people all got kicked loose. So now we have, you know, a lot of crime. As the economy continues to not do well, despite reports to the contrary, we have more and more people choosing to be homeless. Some are homeless because of alcohol and drugs, obviously, but welfare's paying pretty good benefits. So you have all these people roaming the streets, which is causing business owners to clamor for more surveillance cameras.
Yes.
It goes right back around. So what a great way to get everybody to enslave themselves. We need those surveillance cameras. We've got to do it. Do we have another quick break, Bob, on that note, on that unhappy note? All right, we're going to come back with more from Patrick Wood on technocracy and related things. Hey, Pat, when we come back, give us a little overview on Obama's 2030 plan on how likely it is we're going to see much of it in the next year.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I know. That's another little piece of the puzzle. Join us online.
That's a story.
WeThePeopleRadio.us. All the information is there for you.
The more you ignore me, the closer I get. when they'd brush each other passing in the hall. Sue would smile and say, this place is pretty small. You know love grows best in little houses. If you want to separate where you eat and sleep so close together, you can't help but communicate.
It is. It's all about just getting people to love each other.
Except you're sleeping so close together, it's your neighbor, not your wife.
Classic. Ha. Take a perfectly nice song and we just denigrate it. It's what we do here. Because we have to. If we don't laugh about some of this, we're going to all run out there with little pitchforks and go berserk. So, Pat, what's the deal with this White House 2030 thing?
Well, that was actually a United Nations initiative.
Of course it
Agenda
was.
2030. And the idea is to completely implement sustainable development by the year 2030. And they created this document for everybody to sign. Along the way, it's just, the document was put together more or less privately, over the last several years. But it was all put together and kind of science field delivered and given to them as a package. There was no debate at this last meeting at all. It's just like, here it is, you know, take it or leave it, and you better take it. So they all signed on to it, including President Obama. Congress is not involved in this whatsoever. This is considered to be still a quote-unquote voluntary operation. It's not, however, because while they talk about voluntary nature of it on one hand, they talk about the absolute necessity and requirement for doing it. And just coincidentally, we had the conclusion of negotiations on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is going to the president's desk probably as we speak. And once he announces that to Congress that he intends to sign it, Congress has 90 days to pass it on an up or down vote. No amendments allowed, very little public discussion allowed. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership puts teeth in everything that the Agenda 2030 Agenda has laid out. And it is everything that Agenda 21 was, plus a few more things, but it's essentially the same thing. Just a greater sense of urgency now to get it done by the year 2030. And so the president has signed on to it, and I might add that the president's climate change policy, which he is enacting right now as well, was a product of strategy by John Podesta.
Him again.
Who was his, you know John Podesta, mm-hmm. I'm sure. He's a snake in the grass. Also a member of the Trilateral Commission.
Of course he is.
What's the chances?
Uh-huh. The New York Times said last November that it was Podesta who single-handedly architected the president's climate change agenda and strategy. So that tells you that Obama doesn't know squat. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's an empty suit. He's being fed by these people. Here's your script, dude. Start reading it on the teleprompter. That's it. So Podesta was the guy that crafted this whole thing, and by the way, it was exactly the same thing that the United Nations is doing, because the day before Podesta went to work for Obama, he was part of the He was part of the high level panel of eminent persons on the post 2015 development agenda. How'd you like that on your business card? This is 27 people, including John Podesta, who was the strongman of the 27, who in July 2012 set about to create this 2030 agenda document that the UN just signed en masse on the 25th of September this year. This is where that document came from, the post-2015 development agenda. And Podesta was the guy that probably drove most of the conversation and most of the requirements for this post-2015 agenda. And he was the very guy that came back to Obama and gave him his complete, climate change for dummies.
Sure.
Policy. His quick course. Do this. And you know what's ironic about this? Podesta and his 27 eminent persons on their high-level panel.
Sure.
That's the high-level panel of eminent persons. These people are so over the top when it comes to ego. I mean, you must have to take a test for narcissism even to get close to these panels. I don't know. It's incredible. But
there's a Geiger counter that goes off.
Yeah, that's true.
The litmus test for the high-level panel of eminent persons is you have to be a narcissist. Internally, the United Nations refers to the 2030 agenda that just got signed on the 25th of September. They refer to it internally as, quote-unquote, the people's agenda. The people's agenda. As if everybody had a piece of it.
Yes.
All the stakeholders were this, that, and there, you know, whatever.
Everybody they speak for everybody.
This is the people's agenda. And I look back through the chain of events here and found out that 27 people, probably driven mostly by John Podesta, a member of the Trilateral Commission, were the ones that came up with this stupid thing, had nothing to do with the people whatsoever. It's totally narrow agenda, picked out of thin air by these people who want to control the world. And again, I say it's back to the Trilateral Commission. They were the ones originally that said, we will foster a new international economic order, and that's exactly what they're doing. They're everywhere you turn around, you see these people again. So that's Obama. That's Obama right now. All he's doing is he's just parroting the party line, exactly what the UN said to do. He's doing it because John Podesta gave it to him to do. Wow. And now John Podesta, by the way, is campaign manager for Hillary Clinton. Put that in your pipe and smoke it.
Yeah. Obama 2.0.
Yeah, but,
actually 3.0.
Was he smart enough not to email her?
Let me give you a tip. This is just a speculative tip on the election for next year.
Okay.
Yeah. Hillary's on the ropes. Everybody knows that right now. It'd be a miracle if she lasts much longer. But John Podesta, being a member of the Trilateral Commission, is keeping the Clinton campaign machine alive because they've spent over 30 years building this machinery. They're not going to walk away from it and say, hey, it's been nice knowing you guys, game's over. You know, no more Clintons, no more whatever. But Podesta's hanging in there, and he's the kind of guy that doesn't pick the losing side.
He better be a good salesman.
Watch for Al Gore to appear.
Oh, dear God. Bob just threw up right there on the floor.
You think Biden's bad?
Who says we only have 30 seconds left?
Clean up.
Oh, my God.
Clean up aisle one.
Clean up on aisle one is right. Oh, my God. It should be aisle two. Hillary's on aisle one.
That's true. Patrick, thank you very much. We're out of time. We got to do this again. We
need to talk just about the Trilateral Commission. We ought to do a whole show just about that.
We could
do that twice, probably. All right.
We'll do it.
We will do it. Thank you very much for joining us. And for everybody out there who only caught part of this and is going, what are they saying? WeThePeopleRadio.us. You can get in the know. See you next week.